This podcast is brought to you by Watch City Research, your user research partner. Check out watchcityresearch.com for insightful blog posts and to learn more about our UX research services. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the 97 UX Things podcast. Dan Berlin here, your host and book editor. This week, I'm joined by Bob Thomas, who wrote the chapter Bring Rapid User Research Methods to Agile Teams. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you aboard here. Can you please introduce yourself?
Certainly. I'm happy to do that. So I'm a user researcher, and I've been running my own user research consultancy for 2 years now. Before that, I was director of user research at Liberty Mutual Insurance in Boston. I worked for 12 years building a user research practice in the company. I started as a team of one, and when I left, I was managing a team of 10 user researchers. I also started an internship program at the company, and we were able to convert a number of interns into full-time staff. I'm also president of UXPA Boston, and I'm an advisory board member for the Master of Science program in User-Centered Design at Brandeis University. So as I'm easing my way into retirement, I'm finding a lot of satisfaction in volunteer work.
Nice. Yeah, and can you fill us in on your career trajectory, how you discovered UX and how you, you know, wound up where you are today?
So I've had a long and varied career. I used to teach college English, English composition, and intro to American literature at various colleges in Western Massachusetts. And I also taught at the Maximum and Minimum Security Prison in Enfield, Connecticut. And this was back in the 1980s.
Wow.
And an untenured instructor doesn't get paid very well. And I right. still think that they don't get paid very well. So I moved from teaching into technical writing, but with my English background. And that's where I was introduced to the wonderful world of user experience. So I used to document word processing systems that weren't easy to use. I used to document fonts and typeface designs. And I documented early speech recognition systems. And in all these companies, the prevailing wisdom at the time was that users were too stupid to figure out how the software worked.
Right.
So product managers and engineers would say to me, "Hey, Bob, document how to use our software, but keep the manual to under 500 pages. So at the time, I thought, there's got to be a better way than this. And that's when my boss at one of my companies, our documentation manager, said, "I just read this great book." And she gave it to me as a gift. And it was Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things, which is all about making utilitarian things like teapots and toasters useful and delightful. And the lesson for me was, people are often ready to blame themselves when they can't figure out how to use something. We hear it all the time in our usability studies. Mm-hmm. It's not really the fault of the user, but the lack of guidance that should be present in the design that's the cause of the problem. And I have kind of a funny story about my first usability test.
Tell us, what do you got?
Okay, so this is a true story. So the first usability test I ran was for people to complete what we thought was a simple task. Find this typeface font and install it on this computer. Mm-hmm. Now remember, this is the early 1990s. So I started the study by asking my participant to turn on the computer. And this is what she did. She picked up her mouse, she pointed it at the computer monitor, and she clicked.
It's a good start.
Yes. So after that pilot session, we ran the study with the computer turned on. So the lesson for me was, always know at what point you should start your research study.
Yes, indeed. It's a good lesson.
But it was really Don Norman's book, The Design of Everyday Things, that turned things around for me and made me think, you know, why am I documenting these systems with these large manuals? And shouldn't we be designing software that doesn't need large manuals?
Yep.
And my trajectory went there into product management, then to Bentley College, and then to Liberty Mutual Insurance.
Gotcha. Thanks for that. Teaching in the very beginning there. Is there anything applicable to UX that you bring from your teaching experience?
I had very different audiences, so I would have to be very flexible and customize my classes for the audience.
Yep.
So, for example, at Westfield State College, I ran, instead of teaching essays for people, giving people homework, having people report to the class, I ran it like a writing workshop. So I would give people assignments and give them feedback during the session, but basically let them go and talk and or write, I should say, let them write, and then critique them afterwards in one-on-one sessions. And that's, I think that's a good way to think about running user research sessions when we run our usability studies.
Absolutely, the flexibility.
Right, exactly. Flexibility for one thing, but let people go. Don't interrupt them. I think a lot of people, when they start, and especially this was true for me, I would always want to start and say too much.
Right.
And I find that these days, I don't really talk a lot.
Yep. Always tell folks during, you know, when teaching UX research, just shut up. Let the participant talk.
Exactly. And don't give them any clues. For example, I remember one usability study I ran at Liberty Mutual when I sort of mentioned I liked the color blue. And then all I heard during that session was how much this person loved the color blue. And, you know, you can't give anything away in a session. You have to sort of recede and hide yourself and your biases and your likes and dislikes.
Yeah.
You don't want to bias your participants.
Yeah, and the smallest thing can easily bias a participant.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool, so thanks for that. Let's turn to your chapter here. Bring rapid user research methods to agile teams. Can you tell us about that, please?
I sure can. So I chose this topic because collaboration is so important in our field. It's important that everyone, engineers, product managers, marketing people, executives, presidents, watch users fail or succeed. You have to be involved to know what's happening. You have to observe behaviors. You have to watch your customers using your products. And otherwise, you're relegating yourself to building customer experiences based on subjective opinion.
Yep.
And I've noticed through the years how much people build things just based on subjective opinion. And you can't do that. You need that data. When I started at Liberty Mutual, I had a couple of goals that included increasing the visibility of UX research and establishing a research strategy. So I would say philosophically, that strategy was simply understanding customer needs. And practically, I would describe it as test early and often. So I would say my first half of my career at Liberty Mutual, we did plenty of qualitative usability research. We used Think Aloud protocols. We recruited participants. We moderated sessions using task-based scenarios. Now remember, Liberty Mutual Insurance does property and casualty insurance, so car insurance and home, condo, renter's insurance. So I might do a task-based scenario like, imagine you bought a new car and want to insure it. Please show me what you would do. And participants told us what worked for them and where their pain points were. And typically these studies took 45 to 60 minutes and we involved 10 to 12 participants. And we, as a user research team, watched and listened to users. But our stakeholders never did. Liberty Mutual Insurance, like a lot of companies today, are meeting-driven cultures. So everybody has to be at meetings all the time, and I would just hear all the time that we don't have time to sit for an hour and listen to users.
Yep.
So this created problems for us. So at that time, Liberty Mutual was waterfall style, which is just you hand everything off. You know, business systems analysts write the requirements, product managers vet this out with marketing, developers write something, they hand it off to QA, and then at the end, user research gets involved. And sort of the attitude was, well, user research and UX designers are there to pretty things up, you know, which is totally wrong. So it took, you know, it took a total of, in this waterfall environment, 5 weeks for us to run traditional usability studies. We had to spend a couple of weeks recruiting participants, preparing for the sessions, like writing the mod guide, et cetera. We would run the sessions over a week, and then we take a couple weeks to prepare a readout for our stakeholders who didn't watch any sessions but would come to the readouts, the presentations that we gave. And these were what Steve Krug would call big honking reports, right?
Right.
You know, like 50 slides and, you know, people would bring their laptops in and they'd be multitasking. But I'll tell you, when we did a lot of video clips, when we showed users struggling, heads popped up, people paid attention, people listened. And that was really great for us. But if you're working in Agile, where you're turning things around in 2 week sprints, you know, 5 weeks to run a user research test, you know, was basically not going to work. So at Liberty Mutual, like at a lot of companies, we moved from waterfall to Wagile, which is sort of a combination of waterfall and Agile,
yep.
And then finally Agile. So about 6 years into my tenure at Liberty Mutual, our user experience research team tried to incorporate new methods so to meet the needs of our Agile teams. So our goal, as I mentioned earlier, was to collaborate. We wanted to help our Agile teams test design ideas rapidly, you know, validate and invalidate them with real users, share UX insights earlier in the process, okay? So instead of a 5 week process, we could do a 1 week process, or in the case of design thinking workshops, 3 weeks process. Mm-hmm. But what was different was that we required our stakeholders to be involved from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So we would require our stakeholders to watch sessions. In the case of our design thinking workshops, we would bring in anywhere from 15 to 25 people, depending on the project. They would be there for anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And they wouldn't just be sitting there. We required them to be active users. So they would be observing the sessions. We gave them notes pages. We gave them a presentation on how to observe sessions, what to look for, how to be terse and practical. This is where my English background came into play. And so they would write their observations finally on post-it notes, usually just something brief, terse, one sentence, and put them up on these big white pads that we had for each participant. Nowadays, you know, during the pandemic, and I think going forward, we ran remote sessions and we would use a whiteboard-like mural. So people would write sessions, and we would run these sessions. So we would take these post-it note observations. After they were done, we would group them into categories across all the participants, like needs feedback, doesn't want to call, or wants to talk to a human, whatever that might be.
Yep.
We would label each of those categories. We would vote for which categories were the most important, and then we would identify the highest priority category problems. So, you know, during design thinking workshop, this might take a couple of weeks. But if we're doing a user research study, standard usability study, we could do this in 3 days. We could recruit participants from panels or previous participants. We would bring them in over 1 to 2 days. Our stakeholders would be there in a separate room observing the sessions. And then they would be writing their observations on post-its and putting them up on white pads. And then on the third day, what we would do is we would categorize all those observations, label them, figure out what the highest priority items were. And then on the fourth day, we would do a follow-up Find the Solutions collaboration session in which we identified and worked out fixes for the problems found in the usability sessions.
Yep.
So the key aspect of all this was involving our internal stakeholders. And we would get VPs in there, we would get the president of our SBU in there, we would get product managers from other projects in there, and it was so successful that when people wanted to go to the old methods of saying, here, go Bob and team, go and fix these things and come back to us in 5 weeks, we had the authority to say no, we don't do the things that way anymore.
Yep.
We have to do these things the new way. And like I say, It's important to observe users, to watch users' behaviors, so that you know what the problems are right there. And you can see the light bulbs go off. So it worked out.
How did you get stakeholders to dedicate that time?
We had buy-in from management.
Hmm.
We had buy-in from everyone. In fact, we had a whole year long, after we started doing this, the company, and Liberty Mutual is a big company. It's like 50 to 60,000 employees. And our SBU had about 8,000 people. Our SBU, which was really customer focused as opposed to business focused, ran a whole year long series of three day sessions on being customer centric. So that involved listening to tech support calls, actually going around and talking to people in our call centers. We actually went down to our center in Florida and did some work down there, and actually listened to our, like I said, our people quoting for customers, people doing tech support for current customers, et cetera. So getting that buy-in from management meant everything to us. And so they were on our side.
How, so to dig deeper there, how did you get that buy-in? Were there steps that you took to achieve that?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we actually started sort of at the lower level and worked ourselves up. So we worked with the product managers that we typically worked with on all of our projects, who in turn worked upwards, getting their bosses, their VPs involved, and all the way up. The other thing that we did was we did a lot of lunch and learns and a lot of quarterly sessions. So we would do, at the end of each quarter or the beginning of each quarter, depending on how we were working, we would be invited to present and talk about what we had done and the processes that we had gone through. And again, I could see all the light bulbs going off and people going, et cetera, that this is working. The other thing that we would do is we would do monthly sort of baseball card presentations. So this was like a one pager that would cite the top three projects that we had done, the stats on how we moved people. So we increased the first page of online of our online quote by, I think it was like 12% one quarter, and it kept going up. So we'd show them, quantitative data along with our qualitative data. And we might show them a short video clip. So just getting in front of executives and showing them what we had accomplished, along with that quantitative data where we'd move the needle, that really made an impact with our executives.
Yep. Well, that quantitative, that'll always get the business buy-in, that's for sure.
And I remember the president of our SBU, I was introduced to him on the second month on the job. A product manager introduced me to him. And the product manager told the president I did usability. And the president said to me, we need to be doing more of that and talking to our customers.
Mm.
So at that point, I knew this was the right company for me. This was back again in 2008. I had never heard that from the leader of a company before.
Right.
Never.
Yeah.
So it's important to have that executive buy-in. And if you don't have that executive buy-in, then my advice to you is to, work at trying to get it. And if you still don't get it, look for another job.
Right.
Because you're never going to make it in that company. You're just going to be hitting your head against the wall.
Fair enough. How did you go about that transition from waterfall to agile and enabling the team to do that efficiently?
That's a great question. Essentially, as we were working in Agile, we started meeting with the Agile teams. So before it was, in Waterfall, there are a lot of handoffs, as I mentioned earlier. With Agile, we started meeting more with the Agile teams. And in fact, by the end of my tenure at Liberty Mutual, we had members of our research team embedded in different Agile teams.
Mm.
So instead of being more sort of centrally focused and just hiring all of ourselves out to one project, we would be involved, you know, in daily stand-ups. We would be involved in grooming sessions and demo sessions. We would be involved in putting together user stories. So that's how it ended, started out. And mm-hmm. So typically in Agile, you work in 2-week sprints, right? So how can you do a long sort of discovery research or a foundational research project in 2-week sprints? Well, you can do it in terms of user stories. And basically you assign points to people, to your UX team members who are working on something. So a small project might be get you 1 point and be, you know, maybe half a day or one day. Medium, so it'd be small, medium, large, extra large, extra, extra large, extra, extra, extra large. So when you would get to extra, extra, extra large, it might be the whole length of a sprint or the whole length of a PI, which is essentially, you know, 3 months. And so by breaking things down for people, we'd be able to get into that foundational research. We could get that foundational research done. Or with in terms of our user stories, what we would do is work ahead of those Agile teams, ahead by one sprint.
Right.
So doing the research ahead of it, and then and being able to come back to the team and saying, this is what we found, this is what we need to do. Or working in several sprints where we would do the research in one sprint, then work with the designers in the second sprint, and then the third sprint, having our developers implement that.
Yep.
So it involved really working more closely. So probably two things, the executive buy-in, number one, and number two, embedding ourselves in the Agile teams. So decentralizing ourselves.
Great. Anything else about implementing, you know, user research in Agile teams that you were hoping to convey here today?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I think that the most important part is collaborating, working with people, and probably choosing your battles.
Hmm.
You know, choosing your battles is really important. I've had members of my team who fought with product managers over everything.
Hmm.
And I remember talking to very passionate people, you know, want to be involved in everything. And basically I sat this person down and I said, look, you know, you have to prioritize what's the most important thing. You know, getting into a fight over the color of a button is not really, you know, a big thing to work on. You know, what's more important is, for example, making sure that, say, for example, in our quote process, we're not having people ask who's interviewing who. So so you've been talking, for example, on, you know, asking for personal information later in the process instead of earlier in the process. That's where our drop off is.
Mm.
So that's the fight you want to fight, not the button you press at the end.
Right.
So I think just in working with the teams and working with Agile teams, choosing the battles, choosing the highest priority projects to work on, which I think is true of anyone, whether you're in UX or not.
Absolutely. Well, especially in UX, we tend to be passionate about advocating for the users. Mm-hmm. And that can come at very granular points, like choosing the color of a button. So mm-hmm. it's a great point of picking your battles in terms of what UX opportunities to focus on. In our final moments here, we'd love getting a career tip. So either for folks either breaking into UX or who have a lot of experience in UX, do you have a career tip for folks?
Well, I have a career tip for folks breaking into UX and for people in UX,
all right,
if you have time for that. So my first tip for people breaking into UX is make connections.
Mm.
And there are two ways to do that. One is networking. In fact, I think it's so important, I'll say it three times. Network, network, network.
Yep.
So I would say update your LinkedIn profile, make connections on LinkedIn. For anyone listening to this podcast, I'm on LinkedIn as Bob Thomas. You can reach out to me. Happy to connect with you. I connect with a lot of people on LinkedIn. I would also say attend virtual meetups and join local and national UX organizations. Here in Boston, we have AIGA Boston, we have Boston CHI, we have UXDA Boston, we have, of course, my favorite, UXPA Boston, we have New Hampshire UXPA. Joining and becoming involved in your local and even national UX organizations helps. Even volunteer with your local UX organizations.
Yep.
You know, help out. You know, you can also do pro bono work with nonprofits and not-for-profits, include those in your portfolio, and attend conferences, meet people, you know,
yep.
Whether it's virtually or, you know, in person, you know, at UXPA Boston, just a little plug, we run the UX Fair every year. This is for new UX professionals or career changers primarily, and we keep the price low. We run it every year, and it's very popular. The other thing I would say in terms of make connections is seek out a mentor. I think the thing I'm most proud of in terms of my work with in UXPA Boston is establishing with Jen McGinn, another 97 Things author, is our mentoring sessions at the UXPA Boston's annual conference and the UX Fair.
Yep.
I realized the other day that I've been doing that now for 10 years. And we have mentoring sessions at these conferences, both our annual conference, which we just celebrated our 20th anniversary, and the UX Fair. So making connections and seeking out a mentor can help you. And I do a lot of mentoring. And if people want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, like I say, feel free. I'd be happy to mentor. So for people who are in UX, I would say probably the most important thing is to have a point of view. It's important not to be quiet, but to be heard mm-hmm. as a user experience professional. It's one way to build a reputation within an organization. And we can only have that impact on an organization or a company if we're honest and candid and have an opinion. So I don't believe there's any such thing as being objective or impartial when it comes to telling a story. You want to guide your stakeholders, your executives, to come to the same conclusions you do. So have a perspective and don't be shy about expressing yourself. At the end of any project you're on, especially when it comes to presenting your point of view to executives, make sure they agree with you at the end. You know, you need to guide them to actionable recommendations. And, you know, you have the experience and you know how to advise them on what to do. So that is you know, my advice to people in the field now. Express yourself. Have that point of view.
Gotcha. Great. Bob, thank you so much for the great conversation here today in terms of bringing research to Agile and your career tips. And thanks for joining me here today.
It's been my pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
My guest today has been Bob Thomas, the author of the chapter Bring Rapid User Research Methods to Agile Teams. You've been listening to the 97 UX Things podcast. Thanks for listening. The 97 UX Things podcast is a companion to the book 97 Things Every UX Practitioner Should Know, published by O'Reilly, and all book royalties go to UX nonprofits. The theme music is Iron Lung by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, and I'm your host and book editor, Dan Berlin. Please remember to find the needs in your community and fill them with your best work. Thanks for listening.